The virginal conception of Jesus, that is, that Jesus was conceived from a virgin, and therefore the virginity of Mary, is stated in the scriptures. Only in two places, but it is stated there, in the prologue of Matthew, which we read last week, and in the prologue of Luke. Only mentioned there, never anywhere else, but it is there. So it contains a truth that we need to depth. First point, okay? Second point, it is declared in the creeds of the church, starting from the very earliest creed, the Council of Nicaea, and the creedal statement which we say every Sunday, and it says, if you remember, he was born of the Virgin Mary. So that's part of our creed we say every Sunday. So clearly the church, following the scripture, wants us to believe something really important is being said here. And it's part of our teaching, our dogma, our faith. However, point three, there are some understandings of virginity which are either erroneous or show lack of insight. Some of the reasons for the close attention to virginity in times past, I suggest to you, you think about it for yourself, were based on erroneous ideas of sexuality and communication. And we have learnt something, and the way we look at these matters today is, I don't say perfect by any means, because who'll ever get this matter right is a good question, but at least there has been advance in insight that I want to suggest to you to ponder. Firstly, it was thought in some circles that virginity, that is, physical virginity, that is, not having sexual relationships for a man or a woman, was in itself a value. Something to be admired just in itself. Leave aside motives and everything else. But physical virginity was looked at as something untarnished. Can you hear the word? Beautiful, not caught up in the complexities of sexual relationships and so on. That understanding is certainly not Old Testament. Quite the contrary, not that the Old Testament is the last word on it, but in the Old Testament, virginity was seen, I think, the way we see it today. Just of itself, it is a lack. It's a person who hasn't had sexual relationship with a woman or with a man because of their immaturity or because of their choice or because of their lack of opportunity or whatever. But just to be sexually virgin is not in itself a value. It's a lack of some experience, just in itself. I hope I'm saying that clearly to get you what I mean. In the Old Testament, it's actually a negative thing. No one would have thought of being... It was particularly applied to women, which is still probably the case, but for reasons that I won't go into and that are obvious enough. But when the Bible talks about virgin Israel means Israel who is unable to nurture, unable to produce, unable to have children, unable to continue the mystery of God. They're so locked into themselves, do you see it? Just unable to be productive. So virginity was not a thing to be desired in the Old Testament. We never hear of it. And if someone dies a virgin, everyone's sad because they haven't yet given birth or they haven't yet conceived life. So they haven't yet come to the fullness of their manhood or womanhood. And I think, well, I think we would say today, I would say today, I'll offer it as a, that physical virginity just of itself is not a moral virtue. It's a fact, and it's a fact of the lack of some kind of experience. I'll say more about that, but just the physical side. Another misunderstanding, I believe, in times past, and I only offer this for your reflection too, is that there was an idea that matter, physical things, are, by definition, unspiritual. The contrast was between matter and spirit. And spirit is clearly higher than matter. So this has never been a Christian idea, by the way, this one, but it's common enough even now, and it's common in some religious movements. So the more spiritual you want to be, the further you withdraw from the body, physical things, the world, matter, following my logic, and you withdraw from it into a place where it's just inverted commas, spiritual, something to do with the mind and the heart and the dreaming and the praying, but not involved in the mess of ordinary human life. Well, that idea, of course, is, well, stupid. It's foolish, I think, is not too strong a word to do, and it's certainly not incarnational. God became man. The Word became, what's John's word? Flesh. So we have to see, if we're going to be Christian, the flesh, the body, feelings, matter. We say matter matters. Matter is to be transformed. Matter is the substance of our cosmic universe, and it's got to be good. It's created by God. It's not something to be withdrawn from. However, it is something to be enspirited. We don't distinguish spirit and matter. Spirit is the Spirit of God, the breath of God, and the breath of God is breathed into the clay of human life. And the clay, that is, using the image again, the human physical thing, is enspirited. And the idea is that the spirit goes right through us. Our thoughts, our feelings, our body, our senses, our physical relationships, and everything are meant to be spiritual. Get it? Enspirited, more and more, open to the spirit. They're not contradictory. It's not dualism, matter and spirit. It's enspirited matter. That's our world. And the beauty is to have the whole of the human being, including the sexual human being, transformed and inspirited and open to grace. There has been a tendency in the past, even in our youth perhaps, to think of sexuality as dangerous. And I don't think anyone in this room would say it's not. The passion is somehow irrational. It can get you into all kinds of trouble. It can get you away from your... You can lose your balance and your sense. And so, because it's dangerous, there used to be advice around. It may still be around. It's like a cliff. If there's a cliff there, the further you keep away from the cliff, the less likely you are to fall. So, stay right over here. And when I was a young man, I was told that any sexual thought was mortal sin, just about. Well, I was a young boy. I had them fairly frequently. Run into confession fairly regularly. Not quite, but you know what I mean? It's just... So everything to do with sexuality is not only sinful, but it's really serious. So we kept... Well, this isn't quite far enough, really. You should be just as far as you possibly can away because it's dangerous. It is dangerous, of course. And I hope some of you know a lot more about it than I do. But it is dangerous, but do you not climb a mountain because the higher you go, the more you're going to fall? Aren't you? So don't climb mountains, whatever you do, because you could get vertigo and fall over. So that gets rid of mountains. It actually gets rid of everything. Do you know anything that isn't dangerous? So you'd end up paralyzed, and some people do. And in our fear of sexuality and fear of the feminine, if I could put it from a masculine point of view, I don't know what you women feel about us, I suppose we have nothing to be afraid of. But anyhow, whatever it is, that is a factor. So it's like someone says, I think there's a fire somewhere in the building. So we all get out, everything, and flood the whole place. Flood the lot. Put water up to an inch, a foot thick, all over the building, in case there could be a fire somewhere. Well, that was part of the human attitude to this matter. I suggest those thoughts I've given you so far aren't very sensible. Some sensible ones, I hope. We believe that sexuality is good. God made man and woman, and he saw that it was good. No one here will disagree with that. Secondly, we say it's a sacrament. That's a terrifically beautiful thing to say. It's actually a vehicle of grace. Not always, and not when it's disordered, but, you know, at its best, when it's purer, and when it's committed love, and all the rest of the qualifications that I'll let you make for yourself, because you'll understand I'm making them. So when it's like everything, words can be beautiful if they're truthful, not if they're not. Well, if sexual relationships are genuine, truthful, committed, loving, all of that, then they can be, obviously, vehicles of grace, sacraments, so that every time the husband loves his wife, God is loving her and thanking her and healing her. And every time she loves him, God is healing him and thanking him and forgiving him and all of that. That's what we mean by a sacrament. It actually makes grace happen. Thirdly, we say that sexuality and the experience of sexuality, engages a very powerful human energy. Now, you can run from it, you can cut it off, you can avoid it, you can put it aside at your own risk, or you can be engaged in it and let it take its own energy, which is an energy towards God, an energy towards the Spirit who made us sexual beings, an energy towards the mystery of God, an inspirited, powerful energy in the force of love, heroism, art, and all the rest of the things you do and I do in our life. Think of how much what we achieve in life comes from that basic energy that we call sexual. You'd agree with that, wouldn't you? It's an enormously powerful energy that has to be, that we would do well to embrace, not run away from. Yet, another thought. Don't know, this is my last, I didn't sleep last night, this is last night's thinking. Are you ready? So this is what happens to me when I don't sleep. You're copying the results of it. Yet, look at Buddhism and look at Christianity, just to take two. There always has been in both these enormously beautiful movements of spirituality, there always has been profound respect for the celibate, for the virgin, hasn't there? There always has been a certain mystique about it, and it hasn't always been misplaced. So we have to somehow hold all this together. They have seen Mahatma Gandhi, you might like to think of, or you can think of any number of people through history where celibacy or virginity, the non-experience of sexual communion, has been seen as somehow a triumph of the human spirit. As I've tried to suggest, some of that's been misplaced, but I would doubt if all of it's been misplaced. So can we come back again and look at this question? Is there any value at all in virginity in the light of what we know about Jesus and so on? And I suggest this to you as a next thought. This is all logical in case you didn't think it was. That sexual passion, don't all nod when I say this, but sexual passion doesn't necessarily lead to spiritual love. That's obvious. Look at the terrible crimes that go on every day in the name of sexual passion. It's not automatically, it should, can, and if disciplined and purified, it obviously does lead to fantastic energy for spiritual growth. But it doesn't necessarily of itself do that. On the contrary, there is a lot of irrational in it. There is a lot of, and there can be a lot of self-serving in it. We can descend through sexual experience. We can descend into an enclosed egoism, a very self-centered, selfish, even such that we will use people to get sexual pleasure for us rather than to love them. And we know that. And I'm sure husband and wife make that mistake, and every one of us is struggling to purify our loving, aren't we? I mean, it's not automatically pure. So there is a kind of a negative element in it, as in everything human. Sin does corrupt this, and we can be sucked in by sexual experience into a kind of maelstrom, if I could use that word, a whirlpool of chaotic forces that clearly show themselves in the awful rapes during war and all the other horrible things that appear in our newspapers every day. Another thought. Love can be very beautiful where sexual experience is either not possible for some reason or not appropriate. And do you know that too? You can see old people sometime who've lived together, say, in marriage for 50 or 60 years. There may be reasons why they cannot have sexual relationships, but no one here would say their love was less for that. They've come to a beautiful understanding, a spiritual communion, and in a way, isn't that what all love is leading to? I would imagine that everyone who wants to experience sexual communion with someone is ultimately, whether we know it or not, looking for a deep spiritual love. And that the sexual communion or sexual experience without a deep spiritual love is awfully unsatisfying. So that there is a kind of a direction in the human spirit, a direction that picks up everything, the whole world is to be sanctified, but it directs itself towards communion with God, for whom we long. And all love, sacramental love included, is a sacrament of something beyond it, which is communion with the Spirit of God and communion with another person in a total oneness, in peace, that can transcend the experience of the physical. So that's our kind of question. Can love transcend sexual union? I think we'd all say it can. Commonly, it would be foolish to try, I would imagine, because that's the normal process, is through matter, the body and so on, we gradually become more and more attuned spiritually. That's the journey normally. But is it possible for someone to be a virgin? We're getting close to our subject, I hope you can see that I'm not drifting from it. Is it possible for someone to be a virgin and be mature? And be very loving, and be very spiritually in communion with someone in a way that is, by human standards, beautiful? That's our question. I suggest that there is a direction, and this is just to ponder for you if you want to ponder it, that there is a direction in the whole evolution, without taking on board the whole evolutionary theory. There is if you look at the simplest forms of matter, you might have one cell, an amoeba or something, and it's one being. The beautiful things that we experience, let's take a human being, for example, one of the most beautiful creatures we could imagine, there's an incredible complexity about us, isn't there? All the cells that do different things, all the functions that we perform, the whole chemical and nervous, electrical structure, and all that, just looking at it physically, and the backbone and all that. But all of this complex creature, I'm not an amoeba, a one-cell creature, and neither are you. But all of that is in unity. All of that is bound into one being. What a miracle. Look at the cosmos. All of it somehow in harmony. The sun going round another sun, and the whole business of it is extraordinary order and beauty. And the evolutionary drive, if I could use that word, all the direction of the spirit is all towards God, who is one. Leaving aside even the beauty of the Trinity. God is one, and the whole world is actually one. And a love that can encompass the whole world in one is a fantastic thing. The love that probably took over Israel yesterday at the tragic time of the funeral of their prime minister, that's a very advanced thing, isn't it? That a whole country could be in love. What a beautiful thing that would be. More beautiful than me and you being in love. And so mum and dad being in love is beautiful. Mum, dad, and in our case, our family, 8 children being in love. What an achievement of the human spirit. Mum, dad, 8 children, and a whole suburb in love. You can see what a wonderful thing that would be. What about the whole world? So love is, of itself, love is what God is a combining element to encompass the whole of creation, ultimately, if we could. And so, the energy of love is consummated always, I suggest to you, in the Spirit. The Spirit is purified more and more. Matter is enspirited, but there is a direction towards communion and unity, which we'll call heaven, the beatific vision, or that love communion which you and I experience at its most beautiful, which we call spiritual love. So, and now I ask you to think of this, is it right that the consummation even of sexual love coincides with communion with God? When sexual love is at its most refined, it is coinciding with the communion of the two people with God. The question I ask you to think about is, can the pull, I'll use that word, the gravity of personal divine centre, can it be experienced with sufficient force and like a magnetic field? Can it magnetize a person in such a way as to sublimate the natural attraction to embrace another human being? It's dangerous, but can it do that? Can a person be so much grasped by God's love, that that person can actually transcend sexual communion without danger or without hurt, and yet pick up the very movement of sexuality into communion with God. Can that happen, is the question. Can we converge on the divine, we human beings, without the actual physical sexual communion, which not only takes us, if at its best, to God, but can burn up energy too, which can take away from our journey towards God? I think you'd all agree with that. It can dissipate energy as well as direct it. All right, nearly at the end, and then it's your turn. The answer must be yes, because we look at Jesus and we see the greatest lover the world has ever known, and he was celibate. And they slung off at him in his own day. They called him a eunuch. You know that from Matthew 12. A eunuch is a bloke who can't have kids because, I don't know exactly the reasons, but I suppose he's just fell in between two bricks or whatever happened, but he just can't have children. And they said to Jesus, who was so unusual for this, every Jewish man was married and had children. If you weren't, there was something wrong with you. And so they slung off at Jesus as being a eunuch. You can't even have kids. He chose to love in a way that transcended one-to-one relationship, and because he was somehow caught up in the mystery of God, and his love was able to reach out to every leper and every thief on a cross. And you know the beautiful story of Jesus. So he actually is the reason why, wisely or unwisely, in the history of Christianity, right from the beginning, you can find this in letter to the Corinthians, the first letter, chapter 7, some people, like Paul himself, and then right after Paul has come on, why some people have dared to attempt religious life, like with vows of chastity. That's why they do it. Some may do it. I may do it. We may do it. We may find we've done it to avoid the danger of sexuality. And I've already tried to tell you that can't be a very good reason, and it won't succeed. And if someone tried it and had to force themselves, in other words, they were dysfunctional because of trying it, shouldn't we, the whole Christian community, help them stop trying? Because it's not working for them. They're not learning to love. They're actually finding their love cut aside. They haven't got they're cut up from underneath. They're not finding the energy to become spiritual because they're scared or avoiding or all those things. But some have also, because of Jesus, trusted in him and trusted in a love that can enable them to be, as religious, wedded to the community, wedded to the church, wedded to the poor, wedded to whatever. And we see this also in the secular field, don't we? People wedded to a career, a public service, or of exploration, or of science, or of music. And it's such that all their sexual energy, beautifully, is taken into this creative area. Dangerous stuff, and I know it's a big subject, and anyhow, I better get off it soon, or you'll wonder what I'm talking about. But that's... we see that. Now the question then comes, what about Mary, the one who was closest to Jesus? It wouldn't surprise us if Mary, the woman closest to him, was also a virgin. I mean, actually a virgin, for the same reasons, able to transcend with Joseph that attraction that took her into an engagement because of a mystery of communion, of love between them, that doesn't make her unhuman, doesn't make her less than human, but makes her and her husband, stunningly, mind you, quite able to love with an intense spiritual love that transcends the physical. Why not? People can do that. People do that. Why not Mary and Joseph? So there's nothing theoretically that we need to think, if Mary was a virgin, then she was imperfect humanly. That's not the argument. The problem, the only problem that leaves us a bit wondering, is that she was a mother. So that's where we have a human problem with Mary, just looking at it. If she was a mother, then we have to ask, was there a special miracle here? A miracle, literally, a miracle of God's creative energy that bypassed the ordinary human processes. Well, let's look at that question, because that's the precise question. Firstly, such a miracle is not demanded, like theoretically and theologically, such a miracle is not demanded in order that Jesus be the Son of God. I explained that last week. I hope it was clear. Jesus can be the Son of God whether Mary and Joseph had ordinary human relationships or not. You don't have to not have that to have this. So the sonship of God, the divinity of Christ, stand independent of the question we're asking. That's very clear theologically. So you don't have to have it. Secondly, it is of some importance that the virginity of Mary is never mentioned by Paul. It doesn't appear in the Gospels. It doesn't appear in any of the New Testament literature except the two prologues. So that's a fact that needs to be considered. So we can't be dealing with an absolutely key central issue of Christianity here, like the divinity of Christ or the Trinity or the sacramental system. If it was that central, don't you imagine Paul would have been preaching it regularly as part of the gospel? He didn't. There's no record of it anyhow. So he couldn't have thought of it as really, really key. It's somewhere, if it's true, it's somewhere like a little out from the centre. And that's, I think you'd all agree with that anyhow. The positive aspect, theoretically, as to why in the mystery of God, and I'm only trying to think about this, obviously with faulty thoughts, the positive aspect would be, it would be a symbolic statement from God that Jesus is a new creation. Just as God said, let there be light, so he says, let there be Jesus. By a direct act of God's creative power. Why not? So that's the positive, and he is the new creation, he is a new Adam. But there's a negative to that too, that must be considered. And the negative is, it makes Jesus unlike us in his way of being conceived. And theologically, you'd have to consider that as something that needs investigation. Because the scripture says he's like us in everything except sin. Well, here's one where he's not like us, isn't it? And if he's not like us here, it leaves us with some kind of a problem, I would think, in thinking about Jesus and associating with him. If he's so miraculous and so unique and so different, you can't help wondering, is he different in every other way? And that could dissociate him from you. It needn't, but it could. So I think you'd have to consider that a problem theologically. So now I come to the end. Because of what Matthew and Luke say in their prologues, we must have a heart that's humble and open to believe in the virginity of Mary. And the church's creeds have picked this truth up and accented it. However, because the statements in the scriptures are contained in the prologue material, I think we'd have to have an open mind as to the exact level at which this is meant to be understood. Certainly it means that Mary's first love was given God. Certainly it means that Jesus is the Son of God. Certainly it means that her beautiful love for God is the reason for the conception of the Messiah. But I think beyond that, there'll have to be some levels of uncertainty.